Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Summer Mengelcock. She has just finished her PhD in experimental social psychology at Texas Christian University. She has just accepted a postdoc position at UCLA under George Levitch. She seeks to better understand relationships between biology and behavior. To do so, she investigates relationships between biological factors, including hormones, hormonal contraceptive use, and immune function, and behaviors like eating behavior, mate preferences, cognition, and decision making. And those are the topics we're going to focus on today. So, Dr. Mengelcock, welcome to the show. It's a great pleasure to everyone.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So, I guess that this has something to do with life history, right? But let's start with this question. What happens when people are exposed to early life disadvantages, like, for example, low socioeconomic status?
As you kind of mentioned, yep, it is kind of related to these life history kind of outcomes. But I do want to note that there are, a few different types of early life disadvantage that can lead to different types of outcomes as well, right?
Okay.
So you mentioned low socioeconomic status, so that resource restriction during development. But you can also grow up with things like unpredictable environments, where the strategies you use to solve adaptive problems that work one day might not work the next day. And then you can grow up in areas with high rates of violence, high rates of pathogen exposure, and you can also grow up experiencing more like traumatic or abusive experiences. And while all of these things tend to co-vary a bit and be linked together under this idea of like early life disadvantage or early life stress, they can lead to some slightly different outcomes. And so I'm going to, group some of them together a little bit here today, but just kind of keep that in the back of your head as well. But in general, like in my own work, early life disadvantage, especially exposure during the first, I don't know, 5, 6 years of your life, tend to be found to lead to things like accelerated pubertal development, things like earlier maturation, earlier menses in girls. And because nothing in biology is free, this seems to come at the cost of resource investment in your adaptive immune function. So people who grew up under these conditions of early life stress are found to exhibit elevated inflammation, sometimes glucocorticoid insensitivity, and then a more pro-inflammatory phenotype when they're adults. Cognitively tend to make more like impulsive or present-focused decisions in adulthood. They might do things like smoke cigarettes or use drugs more. They might eat in the absence of hunger if they're presented with food. And following these kind of life history model ideas, they might have more children and invest less in each of their kind of offsprings. And then, unfortunately, shorter lifespans as well. So growing up under these conditions of early life stress leads to a whole host of, behavioral, phenotypic, physiological, adjustments that in the long term end up being more present focused, and that means a shorter lifespan.
But in these kinds of studies, do you control for genetic factors? Because I was wondering if, for example, being exposed to early life disadvantages, whatever they might be, the effects that they would have on each individual would vary, according to some predisposition factors like genetic factors. If there would be individual variation in how people are affected by different early life conditions, for example.
So in my work to date, I haven't done a lot of actually, controlling for specific genetic factors, but obviously everything is a environment by genes kind of interaction, right? So there's going to be a lot of epigenetic related kind of effects that happen in the context of early life stress to produce different outcomes. And there are certainly individual differences in how people respond to early life stress that are, while we don't know the exact genetic piece of it about how this, comes together, there's a lot of genetic factors that might promote differences here. We do know that people do respond differently to early life stress. Some of those things are like this idea of environmental or susceptibility to different environments and like biological sensitivity to context. And so this kind of idea is that some people are going to be really strongly influenced by their environment, whether it be good or bad. And so in a good nurturing, environment with lots of resource access and support, these people are really going to thrive. Whereas in a, more negative or disadvantaged environment, these people are really going to suffer. Whereas other people, kind of do equally well, there's some slight differences, but they do pretty well depending on, any environmental context they're placed in. If they're in a very advantaged or very disadvantaged environment, it doesn't seem to impact their adult, outcomes the same way. And so the authors of this model explain this with like the orchid dandelion example, whereas if you put an orchid in like the perfect sunny window, great conditions, it'll thrive and bloom and be gorgeous and amazing. Whereas if you don't take the right care of it, if you put it in a bad environment, it'll die very quickly. And this is contrasted with like a dandelion. So a dandelion thrives in just about any environment. Pretty much anywhere you go, you'll see dandelions sprinkled all over the place, doing their thing no matter where they are. They don't seem to do particularly better in like a great, perfect environment than they do in kind of a harsh environment. And so there's this idea that, kids might kind of be like dandelions or orchids, where some do really well in any environment, and those are dandelion kids, and then other ones are going to do much better in, a nurturing environment. These are our orchid kids, and then they're going to do kind of poorly in a disadvantaged environment. And a lot of this seems to be kind of related to one's HPA axis-mediated stress responses, and how well calibrated they are to the environments that people are in. And so some of this is certainly genetic, and some of it is certainly kind of like, biologically learned throughout the course of one's development. But you can imagine that like if you have an HPA axis mediated stress response, it's very overactive into your environment. Like any little thing that you see that could be slightly stressful, you have a strong physiological response to that stress. That in that kind of case, you might develop like an anxiety disorder, for example, right? Because your body is kind of reacting to everything in the environment, even when these things aren't necessarily threats. But a similarly active, stress response in a very stressful and threatening environment could lead to much more, positive outcomes in a person because they're like actually calibrated to the environment that they're in. So it seems to matter that your stress response kind of matches up to the environmental conditions that you're faced with. But there's also just individual differences in this kind of stuff too. Other factors, it seems that, across many biological species that males are more susceptible to environmental influences than are females. Females kind of tend to be a little more dandelion-like across the board, whereas males tend to be a little more orchid-like across the board. And there's a lot of other things too, like, I think of them as like buffering factors, but if you are in a stressful early life environment, but you have really supportive parents who, make sure that you always have the things you need and are emotionally supportive and that kind of thing, you're probably going to do better later in life than if you don't have very attentive parents. If there's programs in your community that prevent people with low socioeconomic status from being truly food insecure, then you're not going to have the same outcomes for that person as someone who was more food insecure, even though they had maybe had the same socioeconomic status, for example. Other things like maybe being taught to manage stressors, from an early age in your life might help you to kind of, modify your own stress response in ways that can lead to better adult outcomes as well. So, there's a lot going on here as far as there's tons of individual differences, and I don't think that we've explored them nearly enough to know what all of them are, but those are some of kind of the broader ones that I can think of here.
Mm-hmm. But do you know if it has anything to do with personality traits, for example?
Let's see. I mean, as far as early life stress goes, I don't think I've specifically looked a lot at early life stress and, personality overall, other than, some of the things that we'll talk about maybe later a bit about like, impulsivity and things of that nature. I do know that, there's some relationships between some things that come out of that early life stress environment, like pro-inflammatory tendencies and personality, where like in some of my work, I find that people who are more genetically predisposed to have a pro-inflammatory phenotype and people who kind of grew up under, or I'm sorry, and people who have these elevated inflammatory profiles now both have higher levels of extroversion. Which, might be something that is kind of like protective. Like if you're going to Be in contact with a lot of people all the time, it might make sense to have a more elevated pro-inflammatory phenotype in the sense that it would protect you from pathogen exposure. So it could be that direction. It might also be that, you know, having this genetic predisposition for having elevated inflammation allows you to be more social for the same kind of reasons, right? But I don't know anything about chicken or egg there, but I do think it's kind of an interesting relationship between this kind of idea of like genetic predetermination for different types of inflammatory profiles and one's personality traits.
So tell us about what are the aspects of the phenotype that you focus the most on in terms of how these early life stressors affect development.
Yeah, so I mean, there's been a lot of pre-existing research on how early life stress impacts women's or girls' kind of maturation and like sexual maturation, pubertal timing, things of that nature. I don't specifically focus on that, but again, there's a lot of things going on there. Additionally, things like, you know, mate choice, things like that. So like women who grow up in more stressful environments tend to, when faced with a new stressful environment in adulthood, prefer more variety in their mate choice than women who do not grow up in a stressful early life environment. But the main thing I'm really interested in is how early life stress impacts people's physiology and kind of like biological development.
So let's get into that. What aspects of physiology do you focus on the most?
Yeah, so I look a lot at one's HPA axis mediated stress response and inflammation. And I look at those together because they really go hand in hand.
Okay, so the HPA axis, please explain to the audience what it is about.
Yeah, so this is your kind of like most popular or common thought of stress response. So your HPA axis, your hypothalamus, pituitary, anteritary, adrenal, there we go, axis. Is basically how your body is designed to deal with stressful circumstances. So when you experience a stressor in your everyday life, there's a couple response systems that get activated. The first is actually your sympathetic nervous system, and that's going to release epinephrine and norepinephrine, you know, your fight or flight response kind of thing. And that's going to do a few things to help you deal with an immediate stressor, like make you more alert and elevate your heart rate and that kind of thing. But it also signals the release of pro-inflammatory cytokines, or at least increases the transcription of pro-inflammatory cytokines, which are little like protein messengers that can communicate between your immune system and your central nervous system to kind of start the cascade of inflammatory processes. And so this is going on, and then after this happens, basically the HPA axis comes online, and when this happens, a large amount of cortisol ends up being released. And cortisol kind of gets a bad rap because, you know, it's associated with stress and, you know, all these health outcomes and stuff like that, but cortisol isn't really the bad guy. Cortisol is helping your body to effectively manage stressful situations, and it helps your body to return to normal following stress. So you have this rise in cortisol, and that's going to do things like get, glucose that's stored in your liver into your bloodstream so it can be available for immediate use to help you, you know, maybe run faster away from a predator if you're thinking in our, you know, evolutionary kind of historical background here, right? And so it's going to do some things to help you immediately manage stress, but it also acts as a kind of a down regulator of inflammatory activity. And this helps so that when you have inflammation in response to stress, this isn't just something that's going on forever, right? It needs some kind of stopping mechanism, and cortisol is that stopping mechanism. And so, you know, again, this idea that cortisol helps your body return to stress is kind of important. And it's important because when one experiences early life stress or even, you know, chronic stress in adulthood, one's cells can become kind of like insensitive to cortisol signaling, and it prevents cortisol from, you know, kind of serving that down regulatory role on inflammation. And you can kind of think about it as like the boy who cried wolf, right? If cortisol is always being released in high amounts because of these chronic stress exposures or high levels of early life stress, the body stops responding to it. And so because the cortisol downregulates inflammation, this can lead to elevated and exaggerated inflammation in response to stress. So early life stress can indicate to the body that, hey, life is going to be filled with stressors, and you can kind of have two reactions to that. Some people who with more traumatic early life stress tend to develop a very blunted cortisol response to stress. And then some people with more, I've seen it more with like low SES early in life, they tend to have an elevated cortisol response to stress, but that the body becomes insensitive to. And both of these things end up leading to exaggerated and inflammatory responses to stress. And so basically like this idea that depending on the type of stress you're experiencing, you're gonna develop these different types of, dysregulated HPA axis functioning, but they all end up with this kind of heightened adult inflammation. And so, you know, with that kind of thing, like, I guess in general, you would expect to see that early life stress is pretty much always going to lead to exaggerated inflammation in adulthood, even though it can kind of take some different pathways through dysregulated HPA axis activity.
Mm-hmm. And what are the health consequences there? I mean, is it that people that are exposed to early life stressors are more predisposed later on in their lives to develop certain diseases?
Yeah, because in general, inflammation is great for managing threats of pathogens or, dealing with injuries or things like that in the short term. But it's pretty costly to the body in the long term. So there's kind of two different kinds of immune function that your body can invest in development. It's innate immune function, which is going to be this like inflammatory response. And this is a very general response, right? It's the equivalent of like a shotgun kind of thing, right? Where it's like, oh no, something's coming in to harm our body. We're going to turn on all our defenses and we're going to attack it in this kind of way. And this is kind of considered to be like a lower cost type of immune function to develop because it can be invested in to deal with all kinds of general types of threats. And it is kind of, quick to come online, easy to activate, that kind of thing. And so, again, in the short term, it's great. But this is kind of traded off sometimes in these contexts of resource deprivation early in life with development of adaptive immune function. An adaptive immune function is going to be your very like specific immune response to specific pathogenic threats. It's more your T and B cell kind of mediated immune responses. And these are things like, if you get exposed to chickenpox as a kid, then later, if you encounter someone with chickenpox as an adult, you don't develop symptoms because your body like recognizes the pathogenic threat, specifically deals with that, and you don't really notice any outcomes. This is the same kind of way that vaccinations work. But developing adaptive immunity is more costly in development because you have to encounter the pathogen first, potentially getting, pretty sick from it the first time. And then your body has to learn to deal with each of these specific pathogenic threats. And as such, most of the time you see that in the context of early life stress, development is kind of shifted to favor the more innate immune response or this inflammatory immune response, which results in this pro-inflammatory phenotype. So in this case, these people have elevated inflammation and a more pro-inflammatory phenotype. So they're more likely to inflame in response to, any injury, pathogen, even a social threat, things like that, which is costly to the body in the long term because, as we have all probably heard before, like inflammation is related to disease. And it's related to a lot of diseases. So people who have elevated inflammation have shorter lifespans and they suffer more from diseases associated with inflammation throughout their lives. And it's true for things like asthma, any diseases of aging, like Alzheimer's, things like cardiovascular disease. It's true of diabetes. And so really just about any disease or, kind of pathogenic state you can think of, it's made worse by elevated inflammation. A lot of these things, like I mentioned, like the diseases of aging, things that you see people, especially in westernized world, start to develop, in the second, or like maybe like 40s to like 60s, like that time of their life. These things are going to be like exacerbated by elevated inflammation and lead to worse outcomes for people who suffer with these diseases. But also there's health consequences much earlier in life. Kids who grow up, with higher levels of early life stress are more likely to develop asthma, And then they're also more likely to be kind of insensitive to the treatment of asthma, because one of the main ways that you treat asthma is through steroidal kind of medications, which act on the glucocorticoid system. And if your body's not sensitive to cortisol signaling, then you're not going to respond to these kinds of emergency asthma treatments as well as someone whose body is more sensitive to these kind of things. So it can lead to higher rates of developing disease. It leads to being somewhat treatment insensitive to some types of disease. And it also kind of gives you worse outcomes when you're dealing with pretty much all types of disease. This was true for COVID as well. It's kind of a great example of how elevated inflammation can impact one's outcomes. Because a lot of the damage that was done to like the lungs of people who were suffering from COVID wasn't necessarily the result of the virus itself, but rather the result of what's called a cytokine storm, which is when your body notices a pathogenic threat, upticks inflammation really high to attack that pathogenic threat, but then also does bodily damage at the same time. So some of the, you know, worst outcomes associated with COVID had a lot more to do with people's own elevated and exaggerated inflammatory response to stress, or not to stress, to the pathogen, excuse me, than it did to the actual, you know, virus cells that were inside their lungs, for example. Oh, and also, you know, beyond just like medical things as well, elevated inflammation is also associated with a host of mental health disorders. Specifically, depression is probably the, you know, most well-studied, and you can see the strongest relationships, but it puts you at much higher risk for developing depression. And again, you know, having worse outcomes when you have depression as well.
Yeah, so going back to the psychological side of things, what is the relationship or how does immune function connect to decision making, for example?
Yeah, and so I've done some work specifically looking at kind of relationships between early life stress, inflammation, and then impulsive decision making. And impulsive decision making or impulsivity is kind of a wide term that can mean a few different things. So when I'm talking about impulsivity, what I'm talking about is very present focused decisions that might come at a cost in the long term. So for example, we might ask our participants, hey, would you rather have $50 in a few weeks or $30 right now? And what we find is that those who grew up in conditions of early life stress and who have elevated inflammation tend to prefer these like smaller, more immediate rewards to the larger but delayed rewards. And if you're thinking about this in the context of like early life unpredictability, for example, it makes a lot of sense. If the future's uncertain, right? It's unpredictable. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So the future's uncertain. Then you should prefer a more immediate and thus more certain reward to a delayed but now kind of uncertain reward, right? And a similar logic can be applied if you're thinking about inflammation. And so inflammation could serve as a cue to your body, for example, that you're in a poor state. Maybe you're dealing with a pathogen threat. Maybe you know, you're dealing with a social threat. Maybe you have a bad injury, something like this, right? Inflammation happens for a reason. And so in this context of having elevated inflammation, that could be serving a cue to your brain that the shadow of the future is kind of uncertain, right? And in this case, if you were to choose a delayed reward, you don't know that you're going to necessarily live to see the gains on that or to realize that reward. So choosing a smaller but more immediate and therefore more certain reward kind of makes sense in this context. And I should mention too, I'm talking a lot about inflammation and I'm equating it with, you know, some like, you know, bad health conditions or sickness and that kind of thing. And you do get a large rise in inflammation when you're sick or, you know, severely injured or things like that, right? But we all have inflammation. All of us right now have some level of inflammation, right? This is something that varies all the time in response to tons of different contexts. You become inflamed and, or, you know, have elevated inflammation in response to a social threat, for example, or a social stressor. Not just things like, you know, severe sickness and injury. So I'm talking about elevated inflammation. I'm usually just talking about like higher than one's normal levels of inflammation in relatively healthy people. This is a lot lower than what you'd expect in someone who's like battling a chronic illness or something like that, right? And so when I'm talking about inflammation, I'm just talking about like a raised inflammation for one's own self, not necessarily, you know, the most severe, you know, intense levels of inflammation that one might experience when they're in a really, really bad condition. And I think that's an important point to make, because a lot of times I'll send out a paper and I'll mention there for a review or something like this, and reviewers will come back and say, hey, I don't understand how you're measuring inflammation in these like healthy college students. You know, they're not sick. What are you even measuring? It's like, well, hold on. We all have inflammation. It's not just people who are severely ill. All of us have varying levels of inflammation, and this can impact our like decision making on a day-to-day basis. If, for example, one day we have higher levels of inflammation than another day. And so in this kind of line of work, we've only really begun to explore like deep causal relationships between inflammation and impulsive decision making. We have some light kind of causal evidence, if you will, and we certainly find them to be highly associated. But I'm currently working on analyzing some experimental data that I'm really excited about. So in our most recent study, we took our participants' blood to look at levels of their pro-inflammatory cytokines or inflammation levels at baseline. Then we exposed half of the participants to a stressor to increase their levels of inflammation. Half the participants were in a control condition, weren't exposed to anything stressful. And then we had them respond to different impulsivity measures, complete some tasks to assess their present focus decision making. Then we took their blood a second time. And now I'm analyzing these results. So I'm really excited about them, because it's a, you know, well-controlled, true experimental test to see if this experimental manipulation of inflammation and not other things that might just like co-vary with elevated inflammation are in fact, you know, causing this increased impulsivity.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you about specific decisions and choices that people make when developing under those early life stressors. But just a brief comment. I mean, I guess that you would agree with me if I say that when we look at these people that are faster life history strategies or histories, let's say, and they make these sort of more impulsive decisions, it's not because they are irrational or stupid, right? It's because they are sort of adapted to those conditions, and so they expect to live and to make decisions in those conditions. And I mean, when people use terms like bad consequences because of their decisions or whatever, it's just because they are evaluating what people are, the kinds of decisions people are make while living in an industrial or post-industrial society, where we tend to think more long-term, or at least we assume that it's better to think long-term.
Right? Yeah, our societal norms are that this slow life history strategy, or these more long-term kind of outcomes, are, you know, better or good or more important than, you know, focusing on the present. But, you know, it makes perfect adaptive sense if your psychology is wired in such a way that you're not expecting to have an extremely long lifespan. Why would you invest heavily in the future? You know, there's some work that shows that children who, or people who grew up under early life stress, especially low SES and unpredictability, that they in adulthood, especially when, you know, somewhat stressed, make much more present focused behaviors that make sense if you don't think you're going to live a long time. For example, they're less likely to save more for retirement. So they're going to save less for retirement because potentially they don't think they're going to need it. And in some ways, they might be right, given that, you know, their life expectancy is going to be somewhat lower than what we consider our societal norm to be, that, you know, these decisions might actually make a lot of sense. It doesn't make sense to save for a retirement that you're not going to reach, for example. And that might be a, like, you know, it sounds a little glib to look at it that way, but, you know, it's really not necessarily, it just sounds that way because we have this societal idea that, you know, the long term is so important, and that we're all, you know, supposed to live these long, super healthy lives where we focus on the future and plan for retirement and things like that. And, it, you know, it's not going to be the case for everyone. And so kind of pathologizing someone for living in the moment, who then, let's say, for example, only turns out to live to the age of 42 or something like that, you know, maybe they weren't making the wrong decisions. Maybe they were making the best decisions to live the best life they could, or even like, you know, evolutionary, to have like higher fitness during the time that they had on this earth, that kind of thing. compared to someone else. So yeah, kind of that idea that we all have of like, oh, we need to compare this to societal norms and these ideals that we have and stuff like that. It's not a great way to view people's behavior. We should really be viewing behavior, kind of like you mentioned, in the context that it's happening in.
Yeah, much less for us to have a better, a good understanding of where it comes from, right? Yeah. So, yeah, would you like to say anything else?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, yeah. So, like, you know, that saving for retirement is one of those ways that you could see how early life stress and elevated inflammation might impact, like, a specific type of decision-making, right? So what are you going to do with your financial strategy? Are you going to spend money as you get it? Are you going to invest it in a long-term stock option? Are you going to invest it in a short-term risky stock option? You know what I mean? Things like that can be heavily influenced by one's early life, you know, early life environments, but also, you know, one's current levels of inflammation potentially.
So let's go to specific examples. Does it affect eating behavior and decisions people make when choosing what to eat?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it does in the sense like that early life environments certainly seem to impact people's adult eating behavior. We've done a few different experimental studies in my lab where we looked at people's kind of retrospective reports of their early life environments. Were, you know, they, what was their socioeconomic status when they were young? How unpredictable were their lives? How much, what was those, like their resource access like? And those kind of questions. And then we present them with a like eating opportunity. And we're like, hey, here, have this snack. We're gonna let you eat as much as you want, da da da. And we also ask people, or we measure. So we either ask people how hungry they were beforehand, or we measure their blood glucose levels. We've also done some things where we like ask how long it's been since they've eaten, or ask them to fast before coming in. So we've done all these kind of things a few different ways. And then we measure how much they eat. And what we find is that people who grew up in, you know, low resource access environments, they tend to eat the same amount regardless of if they're hungry or full. But people who grew up in, you know, more favorable early life environments, they tend to eat according to their energy need, so like homeostatically. If they're hungry, they eat a lot. If they're not hungry, they don't eat very much. And beyond just seeing this in adults, we've also found this to be true of children. So we find that children, at least as young as 7 years old, if they are, you know, growing up in a stressful, unpredictable environment that with low resource access, that they are going to eat in the absence of hunger. Whereas these same kids, if they grew up in, you know, more benign environments, will eat according to their energy need when they're still that young. And you can really see how that would set the stage for, you know, eating patterns throughout the lifespan of, you know, not necessarily eating according to your energy need, but eating more opportunistically. If food's available, I'm going to eat it. And that makes sense if you're coming from a resource scarce environment where you don't always know where your next meal is going to come from. Doesn't make as much sense if you go on to live in an environment that is filled with, you know, fast food, lots of low-cost eating opportunities all the time, and it can promote the development of eating patterns that, you know, have you eating in excess of your caloric need, which again, you want to do if you're in a resource-scarce and unpredictable environment. You don't know where your next meal is coming from. You need to store, you know, future resources in the form of like fat and extra calories that way, but it doesn't always work out that great health-wise for some of these people who go on to have much, you know, more secure food access in adulthood, but still have these eating patterns that they've developed as children to eat opportunistically or eat anytime food is presented to them. In our modern world, food is presented to us all the time. We're constantly barraged with advertisements and, you know, and even things like in like our work environment, you know, people will bring in a plate of donuts or something like that kind of thing. So we're often given like a lot of eating opportunities, and people who grew up with these like, you know, high amounts of early life stress tend to eat anytime food is offered to them, you know, and so this is going to kind of lead to some longer term eating differences in eating behavior overall. I'm also interested in how this impacts food choice, and I don't have as much hard data on this yet. But I'm curious to see how inflammation, you know, early life stress, inflammation impacts people's choices to eat healthy versus unhealthy foods. I think that probably when we're inflamed, we're probably more likely to make more indulgent and unhealthy kind of food choices. And so I have some data I've collected on this as a part of my dissertation. It was a larger project to look at the impact of hormonal contraceptive use on women's inflammatory responses to stress, and how that inflammatory response to stress impacts a host of other behaviors, one of which is a preference for eating healthy versus unhealthy foods. So I'm excited to see how that comes out as well.
What about mating preferences and mating behavior? I mean, people who are exposed to these early life stressors and develop a sort of fast-paced life history strategy, how does it manifest in terms of mating behavior and mating preferences?
Yeah, so people with a faster life history strategy from that early life stress kind of exposure early on tend to prefer or tend to be like more short-term maters. So they're more likely to engage in these short-term sexual relationships, less likely to be as interested in the long-term committed relationships, which again makes sense with that whole present focus thing we talked about a bit. They also tend to invest more energy in mating overall, and you can see this a little bit throughout like development, in that like women are or girls are developing more quickly, like sexually maturing more quickly, reaching menses sooner, things like that. And so you see kind of some biological like effort towards mating effort, but you also do tend to see more of that short-term mating effort being extended. And for example, in like women who grow up pathogen-dense ecologies, which again are associated typically with more of those lower SES ecologies as well, when they're exposed to pathogen threats in adulthood, they tend to prefer like more variety in their mate preferences. So they like, if you give them a choice of like, hey, here's the profile of 8 different men, you can choose to go on, or you have to go on like 4 dates in the next month or something like that. Who do you want to go on dates with? Do you want to go on repeat dates with these people? They're more likely to pick more varied profiles and to, want to kind of sample and have a date with more men compared to someone else who grew up in a little more benign environment kind of thing, who might just say, "Yeah, I think I just want to go on a date with like this one or two, one guy or these two guys or that kind of thing, and I'll see them more than once." So you see some of that kind of stuff as well. And overall too, that's kind of the relationship between like early life stress and mating behavior and preferences. We also do see some relationships between like immune function and attractiveness, showing that kind of one's general immune function seems to be somewhat related to how attractive people appear. And we don't find this very strongly for the inflammation measures that we looked at, which is kind of interesting because I've talked so much about inflammation and how it has this kind of coordinating effect on our behavior and things like that. But we do find that immune function is related to perceiving people as attractive or unattractive kind of thing. And so it does look like these things are related, but I would be really interested to tease apart more that idea that like maybe early life stress might differently impact the attractiveness of people and how it's related to their different types of immune function.
Earlier, I've asked you about genetics and personality traits. Do you know if there are any sex differences in terms of how people get impacted by living in these lower SES conditions?
Yeah, definitely. Men's immune function is like way, it seems to be way more strongly impacted by stressful early life conditions compared to women's. And this is true of quite a few different species of animals, not just humans. But we do find that the impact of early life stress on one's immune function is much more strongly correlated in men than it is in women that we've looked at. And really fascinatingly, this relationship seems to be associated also with testosterone levels. So these men with really high functioning immune systems that had early life stress also had lower levels of testosterone, whereas those with high levels of testosterone had lower measures or lower levels of immune function across a variety of different measures. And this includes things like inflammation and pro-inflammatory responses to like threats or stimulation.
What about punishment sensitivity? Does it get impacted by also immune function and how it gets altered by living in these conditions?
We did a study in our lab looking at relationships between inflammation, and we were actually looking at both reward and punishment sensitivity in our study, but we found that inflammation was not really related to reward sensitivity at all. But we did find a pretty striking relationship between inflammation and punishment sensitivity. So we did two studies in our lab, and in the first, we raised people's levels of inflammation by stressing them out a bit, kind of thing. We measured levels of pro-inflammatory cytokines before and after stressing them out, and we found that after we stressed people out, those were these like more elevated levels of inflammation. They were less sensitive to punishment, and the punishment in this case was like on a learning kind of task where, or a probabilistic learning task where they had to learn different associations, and then if they got it right, it would ding and it would be like a rewarding kind of thing. If they got it wrong, it would be like and put a big red X, and it was a punishment thing. But they didn't seem to learn from the punishment trials. They didn't learn that they didn't do the associations right. So you get this kind of decreased sensitivity to punishment. And then we're like, okay, well that's really cool, but maybe there's something else going on. Let's do something that more specifically, just impacts inflammation. And so what we did was we gave our participants like a low dose of aspirin. Half of them, and half of them got a placebo. And then we waited about 30 minutes, and then we gave them a similar task, and we found that when we suppressed inflammation with aspirin, that people became even more punishment sensitive than when we didn't. And so this to me shows a really strong relationship between one's current state of inflammation and how sensitive they are to punishment. And so, like, how likely are you going to be to change your future behavior if you were punished, for whatever your current behavior was.
So, since we're talking about punishment, what about the penal systems? I mean, how they develop, how they are created, does it have anything to do, their harshness, basically, with people living in these conditions or not?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was another question that we had, and we wanted to look at it. And so we kind of dug into this question by looking at kind of the rates of disease burden across the United States, and then looking at how that was associated with rates of violent crime and punishment for violent crime. And so we controlled for crime rates and a bunch of other things like income inequality, the percentage of like the population that was like young males because they tend to commit more crimes. We looked at things like sex ratio when it was available, and things like that to see, to kind of control for these other things that could influence these relationships. And what we found was in places with higher disease burden, which should be a proxy for inflammation, because if you're being exposed to diseases all the time, you should, as a population at least, generally have higher levels of inflammation than people who live in a place where there's less pathogen exposure, right? So, the relationship we found was that in places with these higher disease burdens, where we're expecting people to have elevated inflammation and be less sensitive to punishment, that harsher punishments were, more common for these same criminal infractions. So we were looking mostly at like, more like violent crime and property crime and things like that. And we found that people who commit the same crimes, but in places with higher disease burdens, end up getting harsher penalties, like they're less likely to get community service, for example, and more likely to serve jail time. And it's really interesting, this idea that our, even though we're not necessarily, consciously aware that these people have higher inflammation and that they might respond, less well to punishment than someone else, that you see these patterns coming out in our, legal processes. Of saying, hey, these people need a harsher punishment for the same crime if we're going to prevent them from repeating the same crime again. And so it's cool to see that happen in the real world at like a, grand scale like that kind of thing. As a caveat, it's hard to know if those harsher punishments are actually having the desired effect, right? Because, when you're decreased, it's hard to know if the decreased punishment sensitivity is, in alignment with the increase in the harshness of the punishments to a way that's going to actually lead to better outcomes, and less recidivism. But it is certainly interesting to see that that is reflected in the real world as well.
So tell us, what are the kinds of questions you're working on now? What will you be doing in your postdoc? I mean, what are the kinds of research you're interested in doing now, the kinds of questions you want to ask, etc.
Yeah, so I've been really interested in stress lately and how we deal with stress and how that stress response impacts other things. So hopefully one of my next publications that'll come out will be from my dissertation work that I mentioned. So I've been very interested in how hormonal contraceptive use can have some kind of unintended consequences, or you can call them side effects if you want, but this idea that taking hormonal contraceptives is going to do a little bit more than just suppress ovulation and prevent pregnancy. And so one of the things that hormonal contraceptives does is that it seems to blunt women's cortisol responses to stress. This has been known for a bit of time, but it's only recently starting to gain more research traction and momentum as far as people looking at this in more samples and things like that, but it's a pretty well-documented effect. So typically you experience stress, you have a cortisol spike, and then it decreases as you resolve the stressor. But in women taking hormonal contraceptives, they have like a baby spike compared to naturally cycling women and to men. When I say naturally cycling women, I just mean women not taking any form of hormonal contraceptives. And so because of that, and because of some of the things I described to you about the stress response and the role of cortisol on inflammation, I'm really curious as to how this impacts women's inflammatory response to stress. So no one's really, one group of people looked at it in kind of a cool way, but I'm not going to get into it before. It's one small study has looked at this a little bit before, but they only had about 30 participants and that kind of thing. So it was kind of a first pass, if you will. And so I think that what should be going on is that in response to a stressor, that women who are taking hormonal contraceptives are going to have this blunted cortisol response to stress, which is in turn going to lead to an exaggerated and extended inflammatory response to stress because it's not having that kind of down regulation of cortisol. And so I'm curious how this might impact women's behaviors that are associated with inflammation, things like impulsive decision making, food choice, like I mentioned, things like that. And so I'm looking at some of that, and what I found so far is kind of interesting. I conducted a lot of this research, amidst a global pandemic. So people's stress responses in both conditions are a little bit weirder than I would have liked. And so in general, I saw a lot of kind of what we call cortisol non-responders. A lot of studies that look at cortisol responses to stress group people based on whether or not they even really have a cortisol response to stress. And so I have a lot of people in my study who have like a very blunted cortisol response to stress. But what I am seeing is that the naturally cycling women in my study, despite having more of them having a blunted cortisol response to stress, they seem to experience the stress more positively. They report subjectively feeling less stressed than do the women on hormonal contraceptives, and they report a more positive mood following stress and when they have an increase in cortisol than the women on hormonal contraceptives. And this is also related to their IL-6 responses as well. So it does seem that there is a relationship between hormonal contraceptive use and women's inflammatory responses to stress. And my initial results are suggesting that women on hormonal contraceptives might be less able to psychologically manage the stress they experience, and it might lead to kind of more negative moods and more feelings of subjective stress. Which I think is important because there's millions of women in the world using hormonal contraceptives right now, and hormonal contraceptive use has been found to be associated with things like depression, inconsistently associated with things like depression. And it might be the case that one's inflammatory responses to stress over time help to kind of explain these relationships between hormonal contraceptive use and some women experiencing higher rates of depression when using them. So that's the most recent thing I've been working on. And then next, I am starting a postdoc where I'm going to be working on a project that seeks to categorize the early life stress and then the kind of overall life stress experiences of about 800 Californians. Then we are going to take a group of the most stressed people, so our like highest stress, like about 400 or so individuals. and we are going to either assign them into an intervention or a control. Of the ones assigned to the intervention group, we're going to do five different kind of like pseudo-personalized. So there's five buckets, and so we're going to kind of personalize by assigning people to a bucket that we think is the most appropriate for them. These different intervention arms to try to mitigate the impact of these stressors on their like inflammation levels, well-being, health outcomes, things like that, to see if we can't design like a personalized kind of precision medicine approach to reducing the impact of toxic stress on health and well-being. And so we're going to target five different like biobehavioral pathways that are impacted by stress and especially early life stress. And those include just generally like how you perceive and manage your stress, your diet, your exercise, your sleep patterns, and then your social relationships. Because all of these things are impacted by stress and can also have kind of like a stress buffering effect if you're doing them well and they're, you know, going well. But if, you know, you get stressed out and you just stop sleeping and you get, you know, bad insomnia and those kind of things, that's going to have a ton of negative health impacts down the road. And one of the things I'm really excited about this project with is that we are going to be able to collect a decent amount of biological data. So we're not just, you know, categorizing these kind of, you know, life things based on surveys and things like that. We're going to take a very like multi-omics approach to be able to look at genetic factors, which I think is really interesting here, along with, you know, inflammatory factors and things of that nature as well, so that we can kind of try to get a big picture of how, you know, who is stress affecting, how does it affect them, and why, and what can we do about it in the future to improve people's health outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Great. So where can people find you and your work on the internet?
So I have a website, and I don't remember the full name of it. It's like Summer Mangelcook Wix Research, something like that. And that kind of thing. Otherwise, I am on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at PsychedOnScience, and I post a lot of my new work there, things like that. I'm also active on ResearchGate and things like that. And if anyone's looking for any of my papers and they can't find them, they should email me because I'm happy to share my work and I love talking about it.
Okay, great. So, and I hope to have you someday again on the show during your postdoc or after it. I mean, somewhere around there. And thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been great. Thank you for having me.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, hit the subscription button, all of those things you already know. And please consider supporting the show either on PayPal or Patreon. All of the links will be in the description box of the interview, starting at $1 per month, so it would be a great help. This show is brought to you by Enlights, Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Perga Larson, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunder, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Vosbo, Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger, Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Narcio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Pinha, Phil Kavanagh, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Fergal Kassen, Evan Bodrenko, Al Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librand, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yasila Desaraújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Ruzmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevsky, Nelek Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hellman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidis, Saima Fazal, Adrian Yeagi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortés, Ursula Litzke, Denise Cook, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy and Trader in NYC, My producers is our web, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Luis Caetano, Tom Vangnagdom, Curtis Dixon, John Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Giddy, Sardus France, Thomas Trumbull, and Nuno Welder. And my executive producers, Michel Ujeski, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, and Bogdan Canivets. Thank you for all.